Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. My name's Paul Henley. First today, Gaza's health ministry, Hamas-run, says at least 87 people have been killed and more than 40 injured in Israeli strikes on a residential area of Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. The ministry says several victims are still under the rubble and ambulance crews cannot reach the area. Israel called an earlier lower figure an exaggeration. It does not allow foreign media independent access to Gaza. Israel's been carrying out intense bombardment of northern Gaza, killing hundreds of people in recent days. The UN's humanitarian chief earlier said residents there were enduring unspeakable horrors. The BBC's Wira Davis joins us now live from Jerusalem. Wira, tell us the latest, if you can, on attacks on Beit Lahia and how Israel describes them, please.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because images, television images, film footage that we've been able to see from northern Gaza, of course, as you say, we can't get in there ourselves, but these images seem to clearly show several dozens of severely wounded people, including many children, from this reported attack in Beit Lahia, which is a city, a large conurbation in northern Gaza. Now, Israel says this was a precise precision attack targeted at a Hamas, senior Hamas figure or a Hamas figure in the area, and that it had done its best to avoid civilian casualties. The Hamas-run local authorities there, though, say there are more than 80 fatalities, and crucially as well, they expect to find many more victims in the rubble of this building. Israel often says, of course, that these attacks are very difficult because they say Hamas operates from civilian areas, but there have clearly been hundreds of civilian casualties in this latest big Israeli military offensive in northern Gaza, which has been ongoing now for almost 2 weeks.
And we'll be hearing in just a moment directly from someone in Gaza City. But Lebanon has also seen strikes. We're at more strikes. What's happened there?
Yeah, Israel, after, you know, not having hit Beirut for some days, has hit an area of southern Beirut, of course, which is regarded as a Hezbollah stronghold. And Israel said that this was a direct attack using, again, large weaponry on a Hezbollah intelligence headquarters. Now, Israel had, as it often does, sent out warnings via social media very early in the morning to local residents, telling them to leave the area. But again, this was another attack, not just on southern Lebanon, where Israel has been exchanging very heavy fighting with Hezbollah in recent days, but on the capital, Beirut.
And just briefly, finally, Wira, is there any hint that the killing of the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza could be a turning point in this war, from the government, I mean?
It's a good point. There's a lot of international pressure to use this, as was described to me, to use this window, this opportunity to restart ceasefire talks, work on getting those Israeli hostages released. There has been previously some debate within the Israeli government whether they should ease back now because military objectives in Gaza have been achieved. But Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, seems determined to grasp the nettle, to use Israel's military advantage now and to end Hamas militarily before declaring an end to the war in Gaza.
Thank you very much. That's the BBC's Wira Davis live from Jerusalem. Motasem Dalul is a Palestinian journalist in Gaza City in the north of the Strip. And on a predictably shaky phone line, he described to me the situation there currently as basic supplies and facilities became more and more stretched.
The food situation is very, very difficult. Now in the Gaza City, we have only flour. Before 2 weeks, we had canned food. But today we have only flowers, and it is difficult for everyone to bake the flour because there are only 3 operating bakeries in Gaza City, and there is no cooking gas so that people cannot bake their own bread. There are long queues on the bakeries, and people have already started starving because of the lack of food. I went to the people working in the charities which are operating the distribution process. I saw some food packages in the stores, but they said that we didn't complete the arrangement process for the distribution. We don't have sugar, we don't have salt, we don't have rice, we don't have beans, we don't have anything to eat with bread. Regarding the northern part of the Gaza Strip, Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and Beit Hanun, there has been nothing entered into these 3 cities during the past 16 days. No flour, no food, no water, no everything. People who collected some of their stored food lost them because they fled their homes under Israeli bombing. So that people who are locked inside the refugee camp, mainly the refugee camp, Jabalia refugee camp, are starving because of the lack of food and water.
What about the medical situation? We understand several medical charities have been banned by Israel from entering Gaza. Do you know about that?
Yes, I know about this. The medical situation is very difficult. When I tell you that there are some wounded trapped under the rubble of their homes or trapped in the streets where paramedics or volunteers are unable to collect them or rush them to hospitals, their situation is not better while they are in hospitals, because in hospitals there is a very severe shortage of medicine, very severe shortage of staff, medical staff, and there is no capacity in hospitals. There are 3 major partially operational hospitals, Kamal Adwan, Al Awda, and the Indonesian hospital. All of these hospitals have been surrounded by the Israeli occupation forces since yesterday. Today, I spoke to Dr. Mohammed Abu Safiya, the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital. He told me exactly, I'm quoting, "We left many wounded bleeding to death. We only did our best to help the less vulnerable ones." "Why, Dr. Abu Safiya, you did this?" I asked. He said, "We don't have enough stuff. We don't have enough capacity. We don't have enough beds. We don't have enough medicine."
You yourself have lost many members of your own family in Gaza, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I lost 45 close relatives, including my wife, 2 sons, a brother, sister, nieces and nephews. And I have lost more than 100 second-degree relatives.
That was Motasem Dalul, who's a Palestinian journalist in Gaza City in the north of the Gaza Strip. It's a week now since the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrote to the Israeli government giving it 30 days to, quote, reverse the downward humanitarian trajectory in its wars with Hamas and Hezbollah or suffer implications for future weapons transfers and funding under US law. Elliot Abrams is Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. He formerly served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor in the administration of George W. Bush, where he supervised U.S. policy in the Middle East. And he was Special Representative in Donald Trump's administration. He joins us live. Mr. Abrams, welcome. Since that ultimatum from the U.S. government to the Israeli one, nothing really has changed. Some would say the situation has worsened. Do you think Washington made a wise move?
I think there was a misstatement that Blinken was also speaking about Lebanon. I don't believe he was. I think he was only speaking about Gaza. But there have been some news reports in the U.S. of additional dozens of trucks of aid going into Gaza in the last few days.
Which have stopped now, according to all reports. There was a brief window when some trucks went in.
That may be. I mean, I'm looking at the Israeli press today, and the top item is shot at Israel from Lebanon.
We'll persevere with the line. It's coming and going, Elliot Abrams, but bear with us if you can hear this question. The deadline of that ultimatum was after the US election. Would you expect whoever wins in November to follow through?
Not necessarily. Whoever wins is going to be, for one thing, extremely busy with many other matters, including starting to appoint officials for a new administration. And if it's former President Trump, he may well disagree with the ultimatum itself.
Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu are reported today as having had a phone conversation. Seemingly, Mr. Netanyahu told Mr. Trump Israel would make decisions based on its interests. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump has claimed, he continues to claim, he would immediately put an end to the war in Gaza. How?
Oh, I don't think that's possible. One thing, Hamas has a say in this. Hamas has a leadership that's now changing, but they have not given any statements since the death of Sinwar about what it would take to get them to release the hostages. We've nearly not heard from Khaled Mashal or from Sinwar's brother, who may well be his successor. So I don't think it is possible to bring the war to an end instantly.
Do you think that the killing of the Hamas leader, Yahya Sinwar, has made any progress towards peace on either side?
I think it's made it possible. U.S. officials have said to me that Sinwar was personally the main roadblock to an agreement, to a negotiation, and that he opposed all of the proposals that were made. So there is at least hope now that those who follow him will have a different view or will be under more pressure from Qatar and others to make a deal.
Is that hope perceived, really, in Jerusalem?
Oh, I think it is. I think it is. I think there is a sense now that there's a lot of public pressure to get the hostages home inside Israel. And I think there is a sense now that what was not possible a month or two ago, at least according to U.S. officials, because of Sinwar, now might be possible.
In which case, what purpose is the increasingly heavy pounding of northern Gaza serving?
Well, the Israelis say they are pounding Hamas. And we do face the real problem here, which is who is going to govern Gaza? Who is going to provide security in Gaza if there were a ceasefire? So the weaker Hamas is, the better for anyone who's entering that situation, whether it be Europeans or Americans or Arab security forces. The weaker Hamas is, the better.
How do you understand Donald Trump's Israel stroke Middle Eastern policy more broadly now that we could be very close to contemplating it?
I think the better thing to do is not so much look at campaign speeches, but at the 4 years in which he was president. And I think he would try to go back to the Abraham Accords and see what can be done between Israel and the Arab states. He would certainly want to put an end to the war in Gaza and, for that matter, in Lebanon. I just don't think it's possible to do it, or in Ukraine. I just don't think it's possible to do these kinds of things overnight.
Many thanks. Elliot Abrahams from the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. Coming up, Moldova's former foreign minister on Moscow's attempts to buy votes in his country.
Even the need to go for such a scheme tells you that Russia has nothing positive to present, doesn't have credible politicians to support, and has been losing ground systematically in Moldovan public opinion, but in also in the way Moldova positions itself in regional and European affairs.
The news headlines this hour. Health officials say 87 Palestinians were killed in overnight Israeli strikes on an area of northern Gaza where people remain buried under the rubble. Israel has disputed the number of dead. And Israel says its warplanes have struck Hezbollah's intelligence headquarters as part of its latest bombing campaign on Beirut. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC. Across the United States, there are serious doubts about whether all voters will accept the result of next month's presidential election. Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance continue to cast doubt on the result of 4 years ago, and those doubts about voting have, in extreme cases, inspired threats and harassment against election volunteers. Mike Wendling has been speaking to a few of them in rural Wisconsin.
I have been appointed to the office of election inspector.
American democracy at its most grassroots. A group of election workers gets sworn in Black River Falls, town of a few thousand souls in rural western Wisconsin. They're mostly elderly, mostly female, and they'll greet the people that will come next month to cast their votes here in Jackson County. But behind this wholesome display of civic duty, there are some dark feelings brewing.
I worry that I didn't prepare them to be safe.
Melissa Como is clerk of a small Wisconsin town, and she also travels around the state delivering training like this to volunteers.
I've been concerned for several years now about just people trying to tamper with the vote, even on the local level. When people perceive the stakes as being very high, that then they're willing to do extreme actions in order to win.
The main thing driving what Melissa Como is talking about is the swirl of conspiracy theories and rumors being spread by Donald Trump and his allies. They insist that Trump won the 2020 election and that Democrats cheated. The claims vary. They include things like illegal voting by immigrants, dodgy voting machines, ballot box stuffing, and more. But the key thing that unites them all is they've been examined by courts, by journalists, by government investigators, and by officials from both major political parties, and have all been found almost entirely without merit. In 2020, threats were directed against election workers in big cities in swing states, Atlanta, Georgia, Detroit, Michigan, Phoenix, Arizona. But now election volunteers all over the country find themselves a target, even here in rural Wisconsin.
I had a man come in asking all kinds of questions about our voting machine, taking pictures of the voting machine.
Chris Burlingame is a longtime elections worker in Alma Center, a tiny village of about 500 people. Part of her duties is holding a public test of voting machines. Usually, she says, nobody shows up. But in early August, one man did.
He was middle-aged. He had just moved into the area. And he was belligerent. I felt as though we were being accused of rigging it. Because I asked, why are you taking a picture of this? And he said, because these are the machines that changed everybody's votes. But there's no way that it can change votes.
Was it scary at all? Or?
It was a little bit. You know, I wasn't afraid. But it did make me stop and think, what is the election going to be like?
Eventually, the man left of his own accord. The police did not have to be called, but incidents like this are becoming more common. The Brennan Center, a left-leaning but nonpartisan think tank, conducted a survey of election workers earlier this year and found that nearly two-fifths had experienced threats, harassment, or abuse. The Brennan Center's Elizabeth Howard says the think tank started to poll workers about threats following the 2020 election.
The false information about our elections and our election officials spur on the threats that election officials are facing. This is not a partisan issue. Election officials on both sides of the aisle have been threatened.
Just ask Bill Gates. No relation to the Microsoft founder, this Bill Gates is the Republican supervisor of Maricopa County in Arizona, which includes Phoenix.
I mean, even to this day, people are still questioning the 2020 election. You know, it's really kind of taken over our lives.
Mr. Gates suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder because of the threats he received in 2020. And for a variety of reasons, he is not seeking re-election as county supervisor this year. Back in western Wisconsin, the local Republican county chairman, Bill Laurent, says he's not worried about any violence at the polls around here. But he also told me, though he didn't want to be recorded, that he was worried that Democrats would somehow steal the election, echoing those false conspiracy theories.
Who's nervous about observers in the polling place?
After the training session, I asked election worker Chris Burlingame if she was personally worried about Election Day threats.
I don't think anything's going to happen, but I'm not going to have a blind eye. There's just some people that I just don't feel I can trust, and that scares me.
That report from rural Wisconsin in the U.S. by Mike Wendling. More than 70 fake bomb threats are reported to have been made against Indian airline flights this week. The result has been global travel delays. All the flights landed safely, but planes were diverted to Canada and Germany, and fighter jets were scrambled to escort aircraft in the skies above Britain and Singapore. India's government says very strict action will be taken. Our South Asia editor, Anbarasan Ettirajan, joins us now live. Anbarasan, tell us more about what's been happening.
For the past 1 week, dozens of flights received these fake threats from anonymous sources, mostly posted on social media, particularly the microblogging platform on X. And authorities say more than 70% of these threats came from one unverified anonymous account, which has since been suspended. So what it has done is a global disruption of flights, people trying to get connecting flights, reaching to different destinations. As you know, India is one of the biggest airline industry in the world. For example, a flight from Delhi to Chicago, middle of the week, was diverted to a remote Arctic airport in Canada. And then the passengers had to wait there for 18 hours. Then the Canadian Air Force had to bring them back to Chicago because the flight was delayed for nearly 2 days. They had to go through various procedures. And in the same way, as you mentioned, a flight going to London was diverted to Frankfurt, and another flight, British Air Force jets were scrambled to intercept and to escort one of these Indian Airlines flights. So what it is doing is delays in flights, and also as soon as they land at any airport, they are being taken to a secluded area where the plane will be searched for explosives. All these security experts will be boarding the plane, check the baggages once again. So this is causing a lot of financial implications and delay for the passengers. They're missing their connecting flights, you know, stranded in the airports, and this is a real worry for the authorities.
Has anyone been arrested in connection with this?
See, what the Indian authorities are saying is that they've arrested a minor, about a 17-year-old boy, in connection with the threats. But even after this particular arrest, they are seeing these threats coming out. And what the authorities are saying is that some of those who are using these social media posts to send out these hoax threats, they are using VPNs, which means they are not able to be tracing these people and where these threats are coming from. But what they say is there is a pattern behind these messages, and they are confident they can trace them. But again, it is a week, it's a very long time, and this day and age, people might question how you cannot trace an email or even any social media account because the technology has grown. And that is why it is forcing the authorities to reassure the airline industry itself. For example, on Saturday, officials from India's Aviation Safety Body, Bureau of Civil Aviation Security, they met the CEOs of various airlines companies and to go over all the operating procedures in case of a bomb threat, and they were asked to follow the standard operating procedures, and then they are thinking about introducing more. But it is also costing a lot of money for the airline industry, and the government is very, very keen to find out where these messages are originating from.
Anbarasan, many thanks. Anbarasan Ettirajan talking to us live. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. We're NewsHour. Much more to come.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for people.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Over 9 million homes are currently abandoned in Japan, according to a recent government survey. This is mostly due to declining birth rates and rural depopulation. But there are also hundreds of thousands of empty homes in urban areas, even in some of the most sought-after neighbourhoods of Tokyo. So a growing number of foreigners who can't afford a house in their country of origin are now buying up and refurbishing them. Here's our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Khalil.
It's a breezy morning here in Sangenjaya, the small but busy neighbourhood in Tokyo. It's about three stops from the famous Shibuya crossing. Imagine not being far from Westminster in London or Times Square in Manhattan, New York, minus the enormous price tag. I'm about to go and see one of Japan's 9 million empty homes, also known as Akiyas. They're scattered all over the country, including here in the capital, and they've been making waves on social media.
Welcome to my abandoned Japanese house.
Anton Werman is a male model turned renovator, now a famous TikToker, who's gone viral for chronicling his project and selling the idea of these cheap homes. I want to find out why is it that in a country where space is at a premium, millions of homes have been abandoned.
In this case, it was three siblings and their parents lived here. When the parents passed away, they had this house filled with stuff. Just getting rid of things costs a lot of money and also a lot of time.
How much did you pay for this?
About $100,000. What I essentially am paying for is the land. This is 90 years old, and houses in Japan, they depreciate, which means that after 30 years, they're basically not worth anything.
While they may seem like an opportunity, these empty homes are cheap for a reason. Japan's acid bubble burst in the early 1990s, and that meant decades of economic stagnation, which kept property prices low. There are millions of them because Japan's population has been aging and shrinking steadily for 15 years now. Some families have chosen to move to depopulated villages and refurbish abandoned old homes there.
Another reason why rural areas are turning into ghost towns is that young people just don't want to live there. And this is why you get the millions of Akiyas, or empty homes, so many that some villages and towns are giving them away for free.
My name's Sam King. I'm originally from the UK, and I've been in Japan about 7 years now.
I'm Nanami. I'm born and raised in Tokyo.
You guys have actually bought an IKEA. What's that been like?
If we had done a new build, that would have been a lot easier and straightforward. But it's such a beautiful house, and it's nice to preserve that and extend its life.
How much did you pay for the house?
It cost us £70,000, which is about $100,000.
For anyone who's thinking about buying an IKEA in Japan, what would you tell them?
Try and have someone who can advise you on the condition of the property, because some of these places sound really cheap, but then you get in there and you find there's problems with the structure or the water system is completely changing, like this place.
These 9 million empty homes tell the story of Japan's existentialist crisis. Japan is aging and desperate for more people. And yet, it doesn't encourage immigration, so there isn't much demand for property. For Japan's abandoned homes to come to life again, Japan itself needs to change.
That was our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Khalil, reporting. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Voters in Moldova are going to the polls for two votes today. They are to elect a new president, but also to decide in a referendum whether the constitution of this small Eastern European country should include the ambition of joining the European Union. The current president, Maia Sandu, who strongly supports EU accession, is seeking a second term. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, is at a polling station on the border of the disputed region of Transnistria, and she joins us now live. Sarah, how would you describe the atmosphere as people vote?
I might be able to hear a bit of the music in the background here. So as you say, I'm right on the border of this disputed territory, but people have been bused in or taking buses in from Transnistria. They're not allowed to vote there, but they can vote in the Moldovan election. So they take buses and they come to this first town where it's pretty busy. I've seen reasonable sized queues at the polling stations. In fact, there's three or four polling stations just in this one town. As I said, the music's playing. People telling me, quite surprisingly, even people who've come from the breakaway region, a separatist region very closely tied to Moscow, even there, I've spoken to the first three women I spoke to, all told me that they were voting in the referendum for a vote for the European Union, which I was quite surprised by. They all told me they had relatives in the EU. They said that was their future economic integration with Europe. They said life in Transnistria, this pro-Russian enclave, was pretty miserable, pretty poor. So they were hoping to vote for a better future. So that was the first surprising moment this afternoon.
And how obvious, if at all, is Russian interference?
Well, I can't say for sure Russian interference, but I can certainly say that there is definitely interference going on here, because we were in one polling station and my colleague heard a woman coming out, having cast her ballot, saying, "Where is the money?" And she went straight up to one of the election observers to ask that question. She looked completely baffled, completely confused. I then spoke to her and she said she'd been told by a man outside that if she voted, basically, we understand, against the referendum, against the EU and against Maya Sandu, that she would be paid for that. She then said she was tricked. She got no money. But clearly there are signs of corruption and attempts to meddle with this vote. And as we found out, those attempts seem to go much deeper than that.
At Chisinau Airport, staff are on high alert. The sniffer dogs have been working extra hard too lately, searching for money that might be evidence of Russian meddling in Moldovan politics. Ami is a black retriever who gives every case on the baggage belt a good check, specially trained to detect large amounts of cash. When she does, I'm told, she'll freeze. She's done that a lot in recent months, helping to detect millions of dollars on passengers coming in from Moscow. The customs chief tells me at one point there were multiple flights every day, with everyone on board carrying big wads of cash. His team had disrupted a major operation to influence the vote here, ahead of a presidential election this weekend and a referendum that's supposed to enshrine Moldova's goal of joining the EU in the constitution.
Various conversations that we've intercepted, etc., it seems that the primary goal is to have the referendum fail.
Veronica Dragalin is the anti-corruption prosecutor, and she is staggered by a pyramid scheme that means around 10% of the electorate could have been paid to vote no to the EU.
I'm not aware of any other places where we've seen such a sort of brazen and kind of open attempt to corrupt a particular election. It is very worrying in that it's difficult to stop.
Я также призываю вас голосовать против преступных изменений в Конституции.
This is the fugitive businessman who's blamed. Ilan Shaw has been campaigning hard for a no vote in the referendum. In this video, he claims the EU will bring war to Moldova and other horrors. But he's the man who's accused of channeling cash to voters from Russia, where he now lives. It's going to places like Gagauzia, an autonomous part of Moldova that's long been sympathetic to Moscow. The deputy governor is proud to show me how Shaw has been investing here. He calls him his political leader. It so happens he also admires Vladimir Putin, and the war on Ukraine right next door hasn't changed his views.
This is a slightly weird, desolate place. It's called Gagauzia Land. There's a giant rainbow-coloured archway at the entrance and a merry-go-round for kids. There's no one here today because it's really cold. But this whole project is funded by Ilan Shaw, the man who's under international sanctions, convicted by a Moldovan court in this region a political hero figure.
Building a deserted wonderland with foreign cash isn't illegal, but paying for votes, trying to sway elections, definitely is. Ilia Uzun, though, the deputy governor, won't hear a bad word about Ilan Shaw.
All they say about Ilan Shaw, no one believes. He shows who he is by what he does. All this talk about the Kremlin and destabilizing Moldova, that's absolutely not true.
This woman tells me she's anti-Putin and pro-EU. But she's the only one I met, and several tell me the only thing Europe has is gay parades, as they put it. It's the exact same language I used to hear in Russia. Maya Sandu ended her re-election campaign among close supporters, cheered and clapped all the way through the streets with shouts of president. Since her election 4 years ago, she has turned Moldova away from Moscow definitively. For her, the invasion of Ukraine was a crunch point. President Sandu is now calling for a firm yes vote to joining the EU, for Chisinau to make its choice. But it looks like Russia is refusing to accept that.
That was the BBC's Sarah Rainsford reporting. Well, for politicians in Moldova who've long supported leaning towards Europe, the levels of corruption revealed in Sarah's report are no surprise. Nicu Popescu, now fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations, is former Moldovan foreign minister.
It doesn't surprise me, partly because Moldova has been under near constant Russian pressure since even before our independence. Since around late 80s, early 90s, Russia has supported separatism, used energy blackmail, corruption of politicians, stationing illegally troops, introducing embargoes on wines, on fruits, etc. So in this sense, it's not surprising that Russia continues its hostile policies on Moldova, and now it took a new form, and this is this form of putting people, dozens of thousands of people, on payroll and paying them for several months so that they vote in a way that suits Russia.
Is that influence easier to establish because Moldova is a poor country and people need the money?
Yes, there's a degree of it, of course. People who get persuaded to participate in this scheme are mostly people who are not politically active. So there's a degree of poverty as a reason for that. But also, these are people who don't have strong political stances. They are demotivated, disappointed, poor, and they just decide to make some money on. At the same time, I would say that most people don't go through these schemes. And for most people who know who they plan to vote, they are much less likely to fall into this trap of vote buying.
We've heard about these suitcases full of cash coming in from Moscow. How much cash do you actually get if you guarantee to vote the way Moscow wants you to? Have you any idea?
Well, there has been an investigation from a investigative magazine called Ziaro de Garda a bit more than a week ago, which showed how some people are put really on a payroll and they get between 50 euro and 150 euro for every month just to be in this network, come and protest when they are called upon by this oligarch. So it's not necessarily a one-off payment. It's a network of people who got bank cards and they can be paid for several months when there is money for that, when there's an interest to do that. And given that now we have a EU referendum, presidential elections, next year we'll have parliamentary elections in less than a year. So presumably this network, they will try to continue developing this network and getting more people into it and paying people for their participation. At the same time, it's very clear people are not driven by ideas. by a sense of allegiance to Russia. And I would say that even the need to go for such a scheme tells you that Russia has nothing positive to present, doesn't have credible politicians to support, and has been losing ground systematically in Moldovan public opinion, but in the way Moldova positions itself in regional and European affairs.
And in your opinion, how important is this moment in Moldovan history? How key are these elections?
They are very important in the sense that Moldova has never been in such great geopolitical and security danger because of the Russian attack on Ukraine, because of Russia's continued, even though limited, advances in Ukraine. And Moldova's interest is to anchor itself in the European Union, in the European family of nations, as soon as possible. So in this sense, it is crucial. Moldova doesn't have another 20, 30 years to hesitate about where it belongs. And that's why this referendum is crucially important, too, as a next step towards the EU. But having said that, of course, things won't change overnight, and there's more reforms to be done. There's more things to be done to strengthen Moldova's security, defense capacity, and clean politics from these type of schemes.
How has the war in Ukraine affected how Moldovans see Russia?
It has shifted significantly public opinion. You, of course, still have a certain substantial minority of people who view Russia favorably. You also have a bigger section of people who would want good relations with the West and with the East. And this kind of category of people are very much like what you see in the public opinions of Slovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria. There's more countries that have a segment of population that want good relations, that want to be in the EU, but they want to have good relations with Russia. At the same time, there's a clear majority in favor of joining the European Union and deepening ties with the West, with the US, with the UK. And this majority is clearly strong in Moldova, and this referendum is very likely to prove it.
Nicu Popescu there, a former Moldovan foreign minister. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Live from London, this is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Now, over the years, there have been many voices of the famous fictional character Sherlock Holmes.
Mr. Holmes?
Hello. I was studying the faces of our fellow passengers. Fascinating hobby, and sometimes most enlightening.
Oh, Watson. Upon my word, I thought you were too busy to come and see me anymore.
Well, I have been rather busy, I confess.
Oh, if you find your own cases more interesting than mine.
I'm suggesting that it bears all the hallmarks of Professor Moriarty's work.
Imagine someone's going to get murdered at a wedding. Who exactly would you pick?
I think you're a popular choice at the moment, dear.
Someone could move Mrs. Hudson's glass just slightly out of reach. That would be lovely.
Actors Basil Rathbone, Carlton Hobbs, Jeremy Brett, and most recently Benedict Cumberbatch. This weekend, at Alexandra Palace here in London, three newly restored silent films featuring Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's famous detective have their first screening in a century. The three, A Scandal in Bohemia, The Golden Pince-Nez, and The Final Problem, were part of a much bigger series of 30-minute episodes made in the early 1920s. They've been accompanied by a new live score, specially composed and performed by the Royal Academy of Music Soloist Ensemble, conducted by Joanna McGregor. As the final rehearsals were taking place, my colleague James Kumarasamy went to the Royal Academy of Music, a stone's throw from Baker Street, where the fictional detective lived, to speak to Joanna McGregor and to Bryony Dixon, curator of silent film at the British Film Institute's National Archive. That was where the films were restored.
Every age has its own Sherlock Holmes, and during the silent era, the 1920s in particular, there was only one Sherlock Holmes of real note, who was Eileen Norwood, and he is a great actor who's mainly did stage work, but he took up film quite early on, and he's got great gravitas, I think. He does a kind of naturalistic acting style which is understated. So he's not the bipolar Holmes. He is very much, you know, the rather sort of dignified, clever, intellectual Holmes.
And a favourite of Conan Doyle?
Conan Doyle, yes, because this was really one of the few Sherlock Holmes that Conan Doyle actually had saw and had experienced of. And he liked him a lot. Eileen Nord looks great, even though he's older than the kind of Holmes that we're used to these days. So he was about 59 when he started playing Holmes, but he looks perfect, actually. He models himself on the Sidney Paget illustrations from the Strand magazine stories, and he really looks the part. You know, he's got the smoking jacket, the pipe, and so on.
Deerstalker?
No Deerstalker, no.
And no sound to go with it, so these were silent films. They weren't lost, but they have had to be restored, is that right?
Yes, exactly. They were sort of preserved, but we didn't have copies that were screenable to the public. But now we're in the digital age, we can do a lot more to bring the images back to life. We can remake the intertitles, which, you know, supply the words of the story, and we can marry them up with live music as they would have been performed in the cinemas of the 1920s. So no silent film was ever actually silent. It had music. This supplied the essential emotion and dynamic structure that brings the pictures alive.
And you have supplied the cue to bring in Joanna at this point to talk about the music and tell us how you approached scoring the music.
It is an amazing thing to forensically study a silent film and try and work out what you're going to do at any point. They're quite long scenes, so you have to figure out a way of creating music that can follow a lot of talking and a lot of interesting looking. As Bryony was saying, it's very understated and very classy. I would say this is a really classy Sherlock Holmes. He's actually very handsome and rather serious and rather patrician. I think he's great. His foil, of course, is Watson, who is constantly trying to look after him in a very tender way, actually. So one of the great bromances, I think.
And that comes out of the music?
Yes, I have written a little love song for Watson and Holmes, which, of course, the audience might not notice.
And is it from scratch? Because Bryony was saying these films were not shown without scores, but there's no original score to work from.
It's completely from scratch. Mostly in the old days, people would sit there and improvise. They wouldn't write anything down. And I've done a lot of improvising to silent film in the past, and it's been great. However, scoring is much more hard work because you've really got to start and stop in the right place and make a decision about your speeds and capture the essence of the scene.
So how do you go about bringing alive an actor on the screen in music?
Well, interestingly, we're working with an ensemble of 10, and just in that small ensemble, we've got a lot of different colours. We've got brass, woodwind, strings, piano, celeste, percussion, marimba. And in one sense, you want to decide what your colour might be, your atmosphere. So, for example, Sherlock Holmes himself, he's got a wonderful face. It's an older, handsome face, and he very often is frowning. So, of course, immediately you want to capture that as a musical colour, and you might decide to use lower strings or something a bit dark. And then as soon as there's a nightclub raid or a police raid or something like that goes on, you're going to do a different kind of music, you know. So straight away you're thinking about colour, tempo, surprise harmonies, you know.
So you've got the Reichenbach Falls.
Yes, but in this version it's the Cheddar Gorge they go to. Because obviously at the time they didn't have the budget.
So final thought, three down, how many more to go?
Another 42.
42. Yeah, you're laughing, Joanna. You want to take on more bromance and excitement and adventure and problem solving?
Well, I'm sort of hooked now. Actually, I've been hooked in by these films. I think they look gorgeous. And I'm very, very, you know, in love with this actor playing Sherlock Holmes. He's marvellous.
I can tell.
Joanna McGregor, head of piano at the Royal Academy of Music, and Bryony Dixon from the BFI National Archive speaking to James Kumarasamy ahead of the premiere of Silent Sherlock, three classic cases here in London. The latest on our top story before we go, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Tor Venersland, says nowhere in Gaza is safe. In a statement, he adds the nightmare in Gaza is intensifying and the war in the territory must, quote, stop now. On last night's strike in Beit Lahia, where Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says at least 87 people were killed, Mr. Venislan says it follows weeks of intensified operations. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thank you for listening. Goodbye for now.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.